So today I want to introduce the second of our five sessions by briefly going over, summary-wise, what we did last time, last week. And the point there of our discussion last time we met was to introduce you to the specifics of Marx's own contribution to class analysis, his particular way of understanding class, which, as I stressed, was new and different from how other people had understood and used class analysis. Other people long before Marx, other people at Marx's own time, and other people since Marx. Because the uniqueness of Marxian economic analysis, and particularly his class analysis, has been underappreciated, which is part of why this class exists. So what is the key difference, as we went over it last week? Basically, and this is just a summary, I pointed out then that for at least thousands of years of human history, human beings have used a class analysis of sorts to understand their societies and to try to change them. By far the most typical or most frequently used notions of class had to do with the following: that class is about groups of people in terms of how much property they do or do not own. The class of the rich and the class of the poor. The class of owners, the class of the dispossessed. The haves, the have-nots. And that lots of people, both those who liked societies as they were and those who wanted to make changes, thought it was very important to see who had property, who didn't, and to examine the relationships and tensions between them in terms of how that shaped and changed society and how a change could be achieved. In other words, they had, to make it simple, a property theory of class, a property definition. Those who have it and those who don't. And that's how they made sense of society. The second, very different tradition, also very old, also thousands of years old and older than Marx, had a concept of class very different. In this second view, classes were defined by having groups of people that were different from one another, group one and group two, not according to the property they owned, that was the first theory, but rather according to the power they wielded, the authority they had, whether they gave orders to other people or they took orders from other people. Who had power and who doesn't? And there you get notions of the ruling class, the one with power. The powerful versus the powerless, which is very different from the rich versus the poor. Why? Because you can have power and not have property. Barack Obama has a lot of power, but when it comes to property, not much. And there are plenty of people I could introduce you to who really have oodles of property, but wield relatively little social power. In other words, how you understand a society will be different if you think that the crucial difference and distinction is who owns and who doesn't, from what you think and what you understand about society, if you rather believe that what matters is who has power and who doesn't. But in any case, whether you're a property theorist of class or a power theorist of class, those ideas, those ways of thinking about society, long predate Karl Marx. Now, Marx was interested in them. He was a student of them. He thought it was very important who has power and who doesn't, who has wealth and who doesn't. He commented on it all the time. But that's not his unique contribution. If all Marx did was to make use of the concepts of class in terms of power and property, then he would be one of a long line of people who used those ideas, and he wouldn't be the outstanding theorist that obviously he has been for the last 150 years in world history. Marx contributed something new and different. And what I tried to do last week, and I'm not going to recapitulate at all, was to point out that Marx had an urgent interest. He felt that the great goals of the French Revolution, which were his great inspiration, the revolution that happened 40 years before he's born and was the intellectual beacon, if you like, for his generation, that the goals of liberty, equality, and fraternity that animated the French Revolution had not been realized by the middle of the 19th century when he became a mature young man. And he asked himself the question, as many of his contemporaries did, why did the French Revolution, with all its great hopes and ideas, why did it not succeed? Why did we not have, in the Germany of 1848, for example, a society that could be described as having liberty, equality, and fraternity? In fact, it had nothing close to it. So he said the project to revolutionize society by changing the configuration of property and changing the configuration of power, both of which the French Revolution did. The French Revolution took the power from Louis XVI, and all of that. It transferred power to the Estates General, to a parliament. Radical change in the distribution of power. Radical change of the French Revolution in the distribution of property. One of the acts of the French Revolution, you may not know it, was to take the property away from the Roman Catholic Church, which was the largest single property owner in French society at the time. Oh my goodness. And to take power from many landlords, feudal landlords, etc. So property was radically altered and power was radically redistributed. So Marx asked himself, why did that not achieve? Why did that not set us on the road to the liberty, equality, and fraternity? And his answer was, we, the left, of which he felt a part and was a part, we missed something. We didn't see something else that goes on in society that we needed to understand and we needed to change, not only because it needs to be changed on its own terms as an ethical and moral thing, and I'll get to it in a minute, but we also have to change it because if we don't, our attempts to change property and power will also come undone. We won't be able to sustain even what we can change, so we have no choice. So what is this other process in social life, this other quality of society that Marx fixated on? And the answer is captured in one word, which I will elaborate briefly, and that word is surplus. An idea that doesn't exist in distributions of property and power because they're not about that. Here's what Marx figures out. In all societies, human beings, the adult human beings in the community, have to do a certain amount of work. That is, they have to use their brains and their muscles to transform nature. They have to get together to convert a tree into a table, to convert a sheep into a shirt, to convert, and so forth. Take things from nature, rework them with their minds and their muscles to make the goods and services that the community depends on to survive and to grow. And in every human society of no matter what the place, no matter what the time, the following thing, Marx said, is going on. Those adults who do the work, who use their brains and muscles to transform nature, to produce goods and services, and here comes a punchline now, always produce more goods and services than they themselves consume. They always produce more shirts, more hamburgers, more loaves of bread, more houses than they themselves, the working adults, consume. The difference between their output and the portion of it that they themselves consume is the surplus. And in every society, that surplus gets distributed. That's how the people live who don't work, whether they be old, sick people or children, or anybody else in the society who, for whatever reason, is withdrawn from the work process, but needs to get a distribution of the surplus in order to survive. And all societies, whether they're conscious of it or not, and Marx is very clear about this, have to organize the production and distribution of surplus. because there is no other way to survive. All societies that have survived have organized a surplus. And the question is, how do you do that? Societies differ, Marx said, in how they do it. But even more important, how each society organizes the surplus shapes everything else that goes on in that society. And so if you don't pay attention, if you don't even recognize that that exists, then part of what's shaping your life, you are blind to. You do not understand, and therefore the chances of your deliberately changing it to make it work better in your life are virtually nil. In a sense, Marx's introduction of a new way to understand class, now class about who produces the surplus, who gets the surplus, how do they distribute it, to whom do they distribute it, what are the social consequences of all of this, Marx's revelation that this is part of analyzing a society and part of any real, reasonable, hopeful program to change it, is a discovery of something people had not understood, except in bits and glimpses, and he refers to some of those. He kind of puts it together. In a sense, he does for the anatomy of society, this exposure of the surplus, something like what Freud does for the anatomy of the mind, the discovery and the analysis of the unconscious. And in a sense, Marx is saying, let's make conscious this organization of the surplus. Marx then, in his mature life, develops an analytical argument all built around this surplus. For example, the three volumes of Capital. They really begin in Capital Volume 1 with Marx showing how the surplus can be identified and located in capitalism. And I went through that last week in a brief summary way as follows. When you go to work in a capitalist environment like the United States today, and you sit down with an employer and you negotiate with that employer over your job, you get to a point in the conversation where the issue is your wage. And let's suppose you and the employer reach an agreement, you will get paid $20 per hour of your work in this enterprise. The following is true in Marx's analysis. The only reason the employer would hire you to work in his or her establishment and pay you $20 an hour for adding your brains and your muscle to the production of whatever it is that enterprise sells, haircuts, hamburgers, software programs, whatever. The only reason is if every hour of your labor added more than $20 worth of output for him to sell. If he didn't get more than he paid you, he wouldn't hire you, in Marx's language. A condition of work is that you produce a surplus that somebody else gets. You produce it, but you don't get it. The employer gets it. In modern United States, that means, the bulk of the employers being corporations, the board of directors, usually a group of 15 to 20 people, gets the surpluses produced by all of the workers that use their brains and muscles to produce the commodities the corporation sells. Okay, so that's how Volume 1 explains that. Volumes 2 and 3 then explore what do the employers do with the surplus they get from their workers? How do they use it? And how does society develop and change as a function, as a result of how the capitalists take the surplus and deploy it, distribute it? So I have here a summary. We didn't do this last week, but I thought this would work as a summary. The vertical rectangle, TL, stands for total labor, the total labor done by the worker. Marx divides it into two parts, NL, that stands for necessary labor, and SL, that stands for surplus labor. The definition, simple. Necessary labor is the amount of work the worker does the fruits of which are paid to the worker as wage and salary. So it's necessary in the sense, it's the labor you do as a worker necessary to earn your salary, your pay. But you are required to do surplus labor, more labor than what is necessary to sustain you. Why? Because you won't get a job if you don't. They're not hiring you to come and do just enough so that they can pay you. There's nothing in it for them then. So you must do surplus labor. The fruits of your surplus labor, the portion of your output that is surplus to what it is that has to be used to pay you, goes to the employer. In Marx's language, the capitalist, the employer, appropriates the surplus the workers produce. And then they distribute it. That's what this arrow is. Who do they distribute it to? Well, here's one group, the managers. Managers don't make objects. They don't make commodities. They manage the people who do. That's what a manager does. And so they get a cut of the surplus for managing. Here's another one, shareholders. The people who own shares in the company live 1,000 miles away. They do not produce anything in that company. They have an ownership claim. Maybe they own stock that they inherited from their grandmother. It doesn't matter for our purposes. But the corporation typically distributes to the shareholders a portion of the surplus. It has a name, this thing. It's called a dividend. The corporation pays a dividend to the shareholders. That's a part of the surplus. The corporation also has to have lawyers because it gets sued. It has to pay the lawyers do not help make what the corporation does. They never set foot in the production process. But they get paid. How do they get paid? Out of the surplus. The government comes in and says, you got to give us money. You have to pay taxes. Good. The surplus pays the taxes. The corporation, to compete, has to have research and development. It's called R&D. They have to invent new commodities to sell. People are tired of having a toaster. They want a toaster that works in the shower. So you have to have a toaster with a new, and you can sell toasters that work in the shower in a way that the flat old toaster is of no interest. Okay? So the surplus, and what do they all have in common? The language of Marx himself. Capitalists distribute the surplus in order to continue to be capitalists. In a sense, they have to. It is not a choice. You know, in the fiction of the left, we have capitalists as Mr. Moneybags, a kind of round guy in a black top hat, the caricature. And the image may be, even in some of your minds, of the capitalist taking his surpluses and going to the Bahamas and sitting on the beach and drinking alcohol drinks with little umbrellas in them and all that, right? Not possible. Marx made fun of that. The capitalist has to go and secure his conditions of existence. The capitalist must use the surplus to stay as a capitalist. For example, must pay the manager. Why? Because if he doesn't, here's what the workers will do. They will arrive at 9 o'clock. They will be drunk. They will be high. After 15 minutes on the job, they will head into the bathroom and not be seen again for several hours. You need managers. They don't do anything. They make sure that the workers do. You have to have that. Otherwise, you will die as a capitalist. Shareholders. Why do you need to give them a dividend? Because they buy your shares. They give you the money with which to function as a capitalist. If you tell your shareholders you're not getting any shares, any dividends, they may sell your shares and then you're stuck. Can't have that. Why do they pay lawyers? Because given the stuff they produce, you're going to sue them. And they have to make sure that you don't win that case. Why do they pay taxes? That's easy, because the government will shut them down if they don't. That's a condition of their existence. They can't survive as capitalists if they don't pay taxes. And why do they do research and development? Because other capitalists do, and if they don't keep up, they're dead. They'll be continuing to produce the toaster that doesn't work in the shower. You won't buy that one. You'll buy the one that works in the shower, good for the company that made it, spent money, but not for the company that didn't. So if you take your money as a capitalist and go have a good time in the Bahamas, you're going to disappear. Marx was an analyst of the system. And this is how the system works. Capitalism has a unique way of producing, appropriating, and distributing surpluses. And that's really what volume 1, 2, and 3 of Capital, that's what they work out in much more detail, of course, than what I just did here. But it's Marx's surplus analysis. Marx never did anything comparable in the way of analyzing the surplus of non-capitalist systems that he did to capitalism. He wanted to analyze capitalism because he lived in it. He wanted to analyze capitalism because he wanted to get rid of it. So that was his interest. However, he spent a little time, and many Marxists since have spent a lot of time, trying to use this analysis in the way we're going to in the next 4 sessions. That is, apply it, see how it works when you apply it to other issues, other questions. And one of the issues that Marx himself began and others carried forward was to ask about how societies have organized the production and distribution of surplus in different ways from how it's done in capitalism. And I'm going to end my recapitulation with that. He identified 4 other ways, in general, that societies have organized the surplus other than this capitalist way I just described. So I'm going to go through them with you. But before I do, one more word to introduce that applies to capitalism and some of the others. It's the word exploitation. And in Marxian theory and in Marxist class analysis, this is a key word, and it has a very simple, precise definition. Exploitation exists, it occurs, if and only if, when and only when, the people who produce the surplus are different from the people who get it and distribute it. That's it. Not very complicated. So capitalism is exploitative. Why? Because the workers who come to work in a factory, an office, a store, are not the same people as the board of directors that gets and distributes the surplus. Those are different people. Different groups of people do the production of surplus as compared to the appropriation and distribution of it. 2 other systems, radically different from capitalism, nonetheless share exploitation. One of those is called feudalism, and the other one is called slavery. These are Marx's designations. Feudalism. Here the arrangement is, again, some people do work and keep a portion of the fruits of their labor, but they also do surplus, which somebody else gets. But it's not a worker hired by a capitalist employer. That's capitalism. In feudalism, you have something called a serf and a lord, using the European example. In other cultures, they have different names. In European feudalism, by the way, it worked like this, just to give you an idea of the range of difference. Serfs were assigned pieces of land. By the way, this system existed in Europe from roughly 500 or 600 AD to around 1600 or 1700. So it's a system that lasted over 1,000 years just in Europe, and it has lasted for long periods of time in other parts of the world as well. And as you'll see a little later, it exists here in the United States. Lots of it. In any case, in feudal Europe, the serf and his or her family had a little plot of land, or several little plots around a piece of land, and they farmed that, and they kept the eggs and the wheat and the corn, and they lived off of that. And they worked there Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, every week. Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, these serfs had to do something else. They left their little piece of land, and they went to the land owned by the lord of the area, and the area in Europe was called a manor. Manor. And they worked on the land of the lord Thursday, Friday, Saturday. And whatever they produced there, the lord kept. At the end of Saturday, they went home, had a big party, and then Sunday morning went to church to rest on Sunday. You know the ritual. Okay? And so they produced necessary labor Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday on their own land, surplus labor Thursday, Friday, Saturday on the lord's land. They kept the fruits of their own. The lord kept the fruits of their surplus labor. In other words, the producers of surplus, the serf, and the appropriator of the surplus, the landlord, were different people. Hence, feudal exploitation. But why is it not capitalism? Many reasons. First of all, the relationship between the appropriator of the surplus and the producer was not an employment relationship. Serfs didn't get hired by anybody. There was no labor market. There were no wages paid. It's a radically different system. Serfs typically were bound to stay on the land where they were born. They couldn't go anywhere selling their labor power, which all of us assume we can do, because we live in capitalism. Okay? So that's feudalism. Slavery. Here's another interesting system. The people who do the work, the slaves, work all day, every day, 6 days a week or longer, and the fruits of what they produce is entirely taken by somebody else, the master. Not only do the slaves not get the fruit of their labor, they themselves are property of somebody else, which is not the case with a feudal serf and not the case with a proletarian worker in capitalism. That's a really big difference. But here's what they all have in common. The slave does the work, produces a surplus. In fact, the slave, everything they produce belongs to the master, but the master, not being too stupid, usually, gives a certain portion back to the slave because he realizes that you got to do that, otherwise this game is over. The slave will die, and dead slaves do not produce a lot. So, portion is given back to the slave, but a bunch of it is kept by the master. So the slave has produced the surplus appropriated by the master. So they're exploitative systems. Serf, slave, proletarian. But there are two other ways of arranging the surplus that are not exploitative. And here they are. Number one, Marx called them ancient. That has a strange name for him to have used because they existed a long time ago. But Marx himself points out they exist always through history. And I'm going to use the name we're most familiar with here in the United States for these people. Self-employed persons. Interesting. The man or woman who runs their own little craft-making operation. The man or woman who produces software programs with their laptop in their garage. The man or woman who's a dentist or an architect and works on their own. Self-employed, all those kinds of people. The dog walker who collects dogs from the neighborhood and, you know, does or does not pick up afterwards and so forth. These people are interesting because the person who produces software, healthcare, whatever it is, does how much work? Enough work to take care of their own needs? Never. Always do, here we go, more than that. Not just to pay their own income. Why? Because they have to pay taxes to the government too. They may have to have a lawyer also for their business. They have lots of expenses they need to produce a surplus to take care of beyond themselves. So they produce a surplus, but here comes a big difference for Marx. The person who gets the surplus is the same as the person who produces it. No exploitation. And that makes it a very interesting class structure. Always has existed. Just a little footnote. In American culture, that is the most revered, admired, and celebrated class structure, not capitalism. Capitalism exists in our culture with a bad conscience. What we celebrate is the ancient. It's what Thomas Jefferson wanted the country to be. Didn't work out that way, but it's what he wanted. Two-thirds of my students, I think I mentioned this last week, when I hand out cards at the beginning of class each semester and I say, what do you hope to be doing 5 years after you graduate from college in terms of your economic situation? Big smile, men and women alike. I want to be my own boss. No chance in hell, but they believe it. They hold on to it. That's what they want, and that's why they'll be so unhappy in that cubicle on the 18th floor of the skyscraper, which is where they're going to end up. But they dream about, they fantasize about, and you know, imagine a left which understood what I'm doing and which could say to the mass of Americans, you're dreaming of a non-exploitative class structure. You quasi-Marxist, you. And let me tell you that that's an interesting thing. You probably hate being exploited. Otherwise, you wouldn't fantasize about this. But let's leave that. I'm just trying to tantalize you. What's the fifth and final one? The one that's most interesting to Marx, the one that Marx likes, because he doesn't like any of these others. Communism. In that arrangement, the following works. Groups of people, workers, get together as a group. They produce whatever. Software, ladders, shirts, hamburgers, it doesn't matter. They produce enough to sustain themselves, and they produce a surplus. But here we go now. Who gets the surplus? The collective of workers themselves. They appropriate collectively their own surplus, and they distribute it as they see fit to reproduce this communist organization of the surplus. All of these five alternatives, communist, self-employed, feudal, slave, and capitalist, the five, all of them have existed on and off for thousands of years. Most societies are combinations of them. We went through that last time, including the United States today, which has all five. We did that last week. Every society, therefore, has in it whatever the tensions and contradictions are within each class structure, interwoven with all the tensions and contradictions among and between class structures. All of that is going on. Marxian class analysis, therefore, is very complicated. It bears no relationship to the caricature of the capitalists and the workers. Stop. Let me give you an example. How do you handle the worker, the American worker, right? The American worker who goes to work on Monday to Friday in a factory. On Saturday and Sunday, to make a little extra money, he has a truck, and he makes deliveries and moves people's equipment and moves homes and has a plow on the front to move. He works on his own on the weekend. He is his own boss on the weekend. And let's see, his wife, she makes craft articles which she sells to a local boutique. She works on her own, and they have a teenage son who goes to work in a factory. That family would occupy multiple different class positions. Are they in the working class? What would it mean? In Marxian theory, you have to do a complicated analysis to see how people relate to the production, appropriation, and distribution of surplus, because for Marx, that's what has been missing, that's what has to be understood. And that's a very different question from asking what property these people own or what power they do or do not wield. Power and property are important, but they are different from the issue of people's relationship to the production and distribution of surplus. This was the core of what we did. And now I am going to use this analysis to analyze the current economic crisis. And how am I going to do that? I'm going to do it by teaching you a little, I hope, of American history, since, as you'll see, the crisis we're in now is as deep as it is, has lasted as long as it has, and will have the enormous consequences it already shows, because it is rooted in American history. It is not a short-term phenomena. It is not some quickie that will be over shortly. This is a deep product of a long history. So let me begin. For most of the history of the United States as an independent country, but at least for the 100 years from the 1870s to the 1970s, a century, the following statement was true. American workers in capitalist enterprises kept producing more and more per hour of their work. To use the language of economics, American workers experienced for 100 years at least, and it may have been more, going back earlier than the 1870s, they produced a rising output. Each hour of work generated more goods and services this year than last year, and less this year than next year. The productivity of American labor went up for that 100 years. That isn't so surprising. But the next fact is, for those 100 years, the wages per worker, what we call the real wages, the actual goods and services that your wages could buy for you, also went up for 100 years. This process, the capital-labor relationship, the process in which the worker works for himself and works for the boss, produces for 100 years a rising portion of goods and services that you get to enjoy as a worker, even as it produces more and more surplus for the employer. In a sense, American capitalism, for most of its early history until the 1970s, is a stunning example of capitalist success. The workers come to work, they produce a surplus. They are more and more productive, so the surplus gets bigger, that's more money for the capitalists to use to develop, and the portion that they get grows, and so it's a higher standard of living. There is probably no capitalism so far in the history of the world that for so long a period has provided its mass of workers with a rising standard of living. It is American exceptionalism. And why did it happen? And the answer basically is the United States had a problem in its first 150 years that economists will refer to as a labor shortage. We didn't have enough workers. We didn't have enough workers in part because we slaughtered all those that we found here as a nation, so they weren't available. They were dead or hounded into the far reaches of the West or put on reservations. And so we had to bring, as you know, our history is bringing waves of immigrants here all the time to deal with this labor shortage. And the problem was it only partly solved the problem. So for 150 years, the employers had to give more wages because otherwise they wouldn't get the workers. They wouldn't get them to come here. And once they were here, they wouldn't get them to stay in their job because you could always run away west and get some land or get a new job or grow some dope or something. And so it was hard and you had to pay rising wages. And the American class structure, therefore, was very interesting. It wasn't just a successful, stunningly successful capitalism. We went, after all, in about 150 years from being a small, unimportant colony of the big powerhouse of global capitalism, England, to having outstripped England, outstripped Germany, outstripped Japan. Wow, impressive. As capitalist growth goes, stunning. So our capitalism was extraordinarily successful. Brutal, hard. American workers had to work very, very hard, but they had a rising standard of living. That was their compensation for their exploitation. Was that the only class structure in the United States? Not at all. Over those 150 years, the successful capitalism had to deal with serious challenges from other class structures in the United States, which it crushed in most cases. The most famous example, of course, is the Civil War, when the capitalism based in the North and Midwest went to war and slaughtered the opposing slave economic system of the American South, premised on African slaves and a culture producing above all else the number one export that made America a rich country, cotton. America became wealthy producing cotton for export to England. Without that, we would have been a much poorer country to this day. But the problem was, so successful and so wealthy did the South become that it developed the idea that it ought to have a whole country that was slave. And that frightened the capitalists of the North and Midwest, who didn't want a slave society because that frightened and challenged them. So a war happened that was in part, it had other reasons too, but was in part a war between the capitalist class structure of the North and Midwest against the slave class structure of the South. And that's why Lincoln's proclamation to free the slaves is the death knell of the other class structure. You're taking away that which is the foundation of their class system. They were defeated. But that wasn't all. Around the United States, there were millions of small, self-employed farmers, craftspersons, and they were, across the last 150 years, also crushed. Not by a war, but by being competed out of existence. If you ever want to study anything, the drama of it. From 1820 to today, it's called The Demise of the Family Farm. 800 books you can get like that. Studying how American agriculture went from something producing by self-employed farm families, 90% of everything, to today, if they produce 1% of the output, I'd be surprised. Nothing, nothing. Organic turnips and little else. Okay? The end. And the same is true for most other kinds of self-employment. And such self-employment as exists is very subordinated to the capitalists as providers to them, dependents of them, and so on. Well, what about slavery? Did it completely vanish? No. It was crushed in the South where it was serious. But there are pockets of slave class structures here in the United States as well. Prostitution is often organized as a slave class structure. Very interesting in our country. Very interesting. The pimp is the master and the prostitutes are the stable. Okay? Professional baseball has a little of that. One team can buy and sell another players to one another and so on. So we have pockets of it. What? Prison system. The 14th Amendment of the United States Constitution outlaws slavery, a product of the Civil War, outlaws slavery. If you ever read that, it's two sentences. It outlaws slavery except in prisons. That's what it says right there in the amendment. So yes, slavery is also a system that exists in our prisons and so on. We have a big prison population, one of the largest in the world, if not the largest. Okay. Feudalism. Is there a way, a society, a part of our culture, where one person produces a surplus for another? No wages are paid. It's not a hire. It's not capitalism. It's not slavery in the sense that one person owns the other. It's not self-employment. It's not communism. Do we have feudalism? And the answer is yes, we do. The traditional household. Very simply. The traditional household. The man goes out to work in the morning, comes home at the end of the day. He has a job working in a factory, an office, a store, whatever. The wife, traditional household now, the wife stays home. She's a homemaker. Fine. When she makes the home, here's what she does. She cooks meals to sustain herself. She also cooks meals for the husband. She makes her side of the bed, but she makes his too. She throws her laundry in the washer, but his also, etc. She does work. She produces a surplus that somebody else gets. And don't worry yourself that she may not think of it that way. Most workers in America don't think they're exploited either. This is a Marxian analysis. The household is a place where labor is done. And if labor is done, the Marxist asks the question, is there necessary and surplus? Is necessary produced? Is surplus produced? Who produces it? Who gets it? And how do they distribute it? In the traditional household, the woman produces a surplus for the man. Could be otherwise. You could organize it otherwise. Have the man do it and the woman appropriate it. There probably are such examples. There are a few. We even have a phrase in the United States, I believe, called house husband instead of housewife. But it's rare still, relatively. So feudalism, why do we call it feudal in the household? Well, the answer is it's not a capitalist relationship. Husband doesn't pay wages to wife. Wife doesn't produce for husband a commodity which he sells. That would be capitalist. We don't do that. And she's not a slave because you can't buy and sell wives. So what is it? Well, here's what it is. It's a kind of personal relationship. And you know, interestingly, it's the kind of personal relationship that has that moment, the moment of wedding, when you each swear to be loyal and all the rest to one another. Promise to love, honor, and cherish, or whatever the words are. And I always like to remind people that, in case you didn't know it, the marriage ceremony today has its origin, the very words, in the relationship between the lord and the serf in feudalism. When you become a serf of somebody, you get down on one knee, they take the flat of a sword, you've seen it in the movies, tap you on the shoulder, and the lord swears to love, honor, and cherish you, and you swear it back. And in the relationship of love, honor, and cherishing, you produce surplus for him, but he doesn't do that for you. And likewise, in the marriage ceremony, I will love and love and love. It means to the husband, he goes to work, and you do surplus for him at home. By the way, this creates a very complex class analytic, doesn't it? Because we now have to ask the question, gee, might there be a lot of men who are exploited on the job by their employer, and then in the evening go home and exploit their wife? Of course we do. And now what is going to be the consciousness of that man? Which is he going to be more responsive to in his attitudes to politics? His position as exploited or his position as exploiter? And where does it leave the woman? And where would it leave the woman who has to go out and get a job and do that as well as take care of the house? She gets exploited twice. That might create a difference between men and women's attitudes on a whole range of subjects, making the marriage quite difficult. These are some of the interesting ways you can use Marxian class analysis in ways you may not have thought of before. Well, in the history, yeah.
I'm sorry, I just have to ask this. Where do you put unpaid internships into all of this?
Unpaid internships, be a good question. We'd have to, I mean, it's a question I don't have the time to answer, but it's a very good question. And it's the kind of question you could and should, as Marxists, ask of all kinds of workers that we encounter. There's constantly changing definitions of work and job, and we always would ask the question, is there a surplus produced? By whom? For whom? And if you can demonstrate, which you probably can, that interns are often positioned in such a way that they produce, partly they get something and then they produce a surplus, then the answer would be they could be just as exploited under the heading intern as they are under the heading anything else.
Well, I think actually that they're more exploited because all of their surplus...
Go, they get no wage. That's right.
The employer or the capitalist...
pays them nothing.
And they pay them nothing. And really the only thing that differentiates them from slavery is the fact that they cannot be bought.
Bought and sold.
But aside from that, I mean, it more clearly fits into the slavery...
Perfect.
...than into the feudalism or certainly the capitalism, because they're not getting paid anything.
Right, well, you could call it capitalism with a wage of zero. And that... Well, it takes us far afield, but it's a good question. Let me get back now to the crisis. I want you to see how we play with it. Back to the story of the United States. Successful capitalism that smashes slavery in the South, kills it off, subordinates the ancient, the self-employment, but does not smash feudalism. In fact, it celebrates feudalism in the household. The history of capitalism in a Marxian framework is thus the story of a successful capitalism in the enterprise connected to a successful feudalism in the household. They reinforce each other. The capitalist typically pays the man enough money to sustain the feudal household at home. And the wife produces enough surplus for the husband that the employer doesn't have to give him as much as he otherwise would because she's producing. It is cheaper to buy raw food and have your wife cook it than to buy finished produced food article in the takeout. Think, what's the difference? Wife in a traditional household. So a symbiotic relationship doesn't have to be, hasn't always been, but in the history of our country, capitalist enterprises complexly connected to feudal households were the norm from the early 19th century even to the 1970s. Okay? Now that's our class analytic. Now let's follow what happens. In the 1970s, a great change occurs. We're now building to the crisis. A great change that is all the more important because most Americans did not know it at the time. There was no public recognition of what I'm about to tell you, no public debate about what it meant, and basically none since either. What happened in the 1970s? Key. Rising wages of American workers stopped and never resumed. The real wage of an American worker today, 2010, in terms of what an hour's worth of your wage will afford for you to buy, is about what it was in 1978. Very important. Real wages stopped rising. For a working class that had enjoyed rising wages for 100 to 150 years, this was a trauma. Remember with me, if you will, what happened in the United States having a successful capitalism that rose wages. First, Americans began to believe they lived in a charmed land. God must love us because he's providing us with a rising standard of living and nobody else. We're special. And not only are we special in our rising standard of living, but capitalism is the best thing since sliced bread because it's providing it to us. Capitalism is great, we are blessed, God loves us, etc. More importantly, American workers who were pressed to work harder and harder across those 130 years, with more machines, more difficult machines, longer hours, under greater stress, all of that, came to react to their growing pressure on the job by coming to see the world as follows. Work fundamentally stinks, but you accept it because there's a reward to you from work. That reward has nothing to do with work. It's not available to you in work. The reward for work is located at the mall. The reward for work is consumption. Now, that is a very peculiar way of thinking. After all, human beings in the United States, workers, go to work Monday to Friday minimum, 8 to 5 in the afternoon, more or less, which means you got to get up an hour or two before, you got to get dressed, you got to wash, you got to take the transportation, you got to do the reverse on your way home. The overwhelming bulk of your adult life is all about work. It's an interesting thing to decide that stinks and there's nothing I can do about it. And there's nothing I should do. I shouldn't even look there. The work isn't what matters. It's how much money I have to consume with. That's what matters. And Americans had come to define themselves that way. I'm successful according to the house I live in, the neighborhood I live in, the clothes I have, the car I drive, the vacation I take. You know, you don't need me to explain this. We measure one another's success, one another's worth as individuals. We say we are all, you know, into the American dream. We want to provide to our children a better standard of living than we had. And for enough generations, that was true that we all promised that to our kids, a promise we would like to deliver on. So Americans were attached to consumption. I like to use an illustration from economics, the subject I teach. If you take a basic economics course, here's what you get taught very early. You get shown it on a graph, but I won't bother you with that. And you explained labor has attached to it something economists call disutility. That's a fancy way of saying it's a drag. Consumption has attached to it utility. I like it. So how much work do you do? Economics answers. You do it to the point where you no longer, as you do more and more hours of work a week, it becomes more and more onerous. The first hour stinks, but the 10th hour really stinks. Meanwhile, the first hour's consumption is really satisfying, but the 10th hour is not so sad. So you notice the unpleasantness of work rises while the joy of consumption falls, and where they crisscross, if you take economics, you'll discover that economists get as close as they ever get to orgasm when things cross. Okay, so they're very excited about that. Every textbook has that in there. It's a big moment in the textbook. It's really exciting. So when those two lines cross, notice what's being unspoken here. Work is negative. Consumption is positive. You should accept the horror of work, that way you spend most of your adult time between birth and death. You should accept it. You should look for your satisfaction at Walmart, shopping. Now, I don't mean to be cute about it because it's very serious. But the important point, and the reason I'm stressing it to you, is in the 1970s, when wages stopped going up, you presented the American working class with a traumatic transformation. We're not raising your wages anymore. We don't have to. We're not gonna. Before I take you through what it did to the working class, which produced the crisis today, before I take you through it, I need to answer the question I know is in your minds. Why did the wages stop rising? Basically, we solved our labor shortage. Four things happened in the 1970s that ended our labor shortage. Number one, a technical change came through that substituted on a mass scale labor by having a machine instead. It's called the computer. Instead of having 50 people keeping track of how many Rice Krispies go off the shelf in the supermarket, you have a little scanning device that goes automatically by when you buy this, you know, it clicks off on that machine, and somebody, one person sitting in an office 1,000 miles away, knows exactly what your Rice Krispies situation is and whether a new shipment of boxes of the stuff have to be ordered. It's all done automatically by computer. The demand for labor shrank. Second, because of the recovery of our former competitors, Europe and Japan, from World War II, which took from the late 40s to the 70s, they were now the competitors. That's why Americans in the 70s stopped buying Chevys and Fords and all the rest and started buying Toyotas and Datsuns and VWs and all that. So the United States was being outcompeted by the returning capitalist competitor, and they solved part of the problem by moving production from the United States to places where wages were much cheaper so they could compete. So they moved jobs out of the country. Let's stay with this now. Computers meant you needed fewer jobs, and exporting your production meant you needed fewer people. So the demand for workers shrank. Meanwhile, the supply of people looking for work rose. Two reasons. One, a social revolution here having to do with women, the women's liberation. Women in massive numbers, starting in the 70s, left the home to look for paid work outside the home. There, of course, had been women who had always done that, but a whole new, millions of them, moved out of the house looking for work, and new waves of immigrants came here, particularly from Latin America, but from other parts of the world as well. So you had a big influx of women and immigrants looking for work at the same time that the corporate sector had fewer jobs it needed to have filled, partly because of the computer, partly because of export of work. End result, you don't have to give people rising wages anymore, and you don't. The wages stop rising. Here is a graph, very simple. It starts around the 1870s, and it goes right up to the present. It has two lines on it. The upper line is the productivity. How much stuff is an average worker producing in an average hour of his or her work? That keeps going up. We are a productive-driven economy. We make workers more and more productive by more machines, better machines, etc. The computer itself helping to keep this line going. You'll notice that the lower line, the line of wages, goes up for the first 100 years, and then it flattens out. The capitalist-worker relationship changes. The capitalist is suddenly able to get more surplus out of the worker. Why? How? Because the worker is made more and more productive, so the worker produces more and more stuff for the employer to sell at the end of the day. But the employer, who used to have to give the worker a rising wage for doing this, no longer has to. The surplus is simply the difference between the two lines. The difference between what in an hour you give your employer and what for that hour he gives you. Since what he gives you flattened out, stayed the same, while what you produced for him went up, the last 30 years from the 1970s to the present has been a time of unparalleled explosion in the profits, the surpluses garnered by capitalist employers. It was nirvana for them. It was a fantasy that even the most expensive professor in a business school would never have thought possible. 30 years of paying your workers not one bit of increase after having spent 150 years doing it. Meanwhile, getting more and more out of them. If I had a moment, if I had more time, and if I had a recording machine here, I'd play the national anthem. Just for musical interlude, that would be appropriate. Okay, I promised to tell you what happened to the working class. Very interesting. First, they were traumatized. Why were they traumatized? Because if you measure yourself in a rising standard of living that you afford with rising wages, and your wages don't rise anymore, you're no longer going to be able to do that which you think is a measure of your success, your worth. Moreover, if you can't consume more, you can't give your children the promised American dream. You can't deliver to your teenager what you told her you would give her last year on the date of her birthday. You can't do it. And for American working people, this was traumatic. But because in the 1970s and since, there was no public discussion, I will not embarrass anyone in this room by asking you whether you were even aware of the end of rising wages, that it was as dramatic. I won't. Suffice it to say, the American workers were not apprised of this. No president brought it up. No congressional debate focused our attention on it. Nothing. So the American working class went through this traumatic change as if it were a personal, individual experience, explained by personal, individual qualities. It wasn't a social change, it was a personal failure. One of the implications of this, wow. First, with the husband no longer able to get rising wages when he works, a number of things happens. First, he can't secure his feudal household. The unspoken agreement with the wife was he provides the vacuum cleaner, the range, the refrigerator, the dishwasher. He can't do it. He can't replace the worn-out one with a new one. He can't afford it. The conditions of his feudal household begin to break down. How does the family react? Tensions grow. Wife will deliver surplus, unaware of it, but she wants something in exchange, which he can't give her anymore. Rising standard of living. Can't take care of the kids. Can't get them the extra lessons. Can't do it. Tensions rise. Footnote. Starting in the 1970s, the divorce rate in the United States goes through the roof. We become the country with the highest rate of divorce in the advanced world, a position I believe we still hold. One of the things the working class family does to try to cope with the end of rising wages, committed as it is to rising consumption, because that's its raison d'etre, its self-affirmation, is it sends more members of the household out to work. Retired people get a part-time job. Teenagers are sent out to work, but women, that's again the big group, sent out. The woman changes from the notion I'm going to be a housewife to the notion I'm going to have a job just like the husband. She goes out to work. But because of the long culture of a traditional household, the husband doesn't pick up the labor at home since she can't do it, since she's working. And so she goes to work and then come home and still expected to take care of the kids, to clean the place. And then a friend of mine, a wonderful professor of sociology at the University of California in Berkeley named Arlie Hochschild, writes a whole series of books, one of which is called The Double Shift. And it's about the impact on women of having added a double shift, added the shift in paid labor to the already heavy shift they had at home for unpaid labor. And that stretches the woman beyond endurance. Largest consumer of drugs in the world are the adult American women. Way outstripping the men, and way outstripping anybody else in the world, period. What's that about? Our families are riven by spouse abuse, child abuse, drug abuse, blah, blah. Are we peculiar people? I don't think so. I think we put our household under unbearable pressure through this mechanism. And to make a long story short, and to use Marxian analysis, the feudal class structure of the household disintegrated in the last 30 years. Alienation between husband and wife, alienation between parents and children, the ability of this situation to hold, and we now have huge numbers of divorce, huge numbers of people choosing not to resume a married life in the traditional way. They can't stand it. Fastest growing type of household in the United States for the last 10 years, single adult person in the home. What is that about? It's the end of a class. We've had a revolution in one of the class structures of the United States, but nobody, and the saddest thing is as the Marxist left, nobody noticed. Nobody addressed it. Oh, let me change that. Somebody in our culture did address the trauma of the working class as its families and households fell apart. But the sadness of our culture is it was the right-wing Christians and Republicans who figured it out. They didn't use Marxist theory. Heaven knows. And I chose heaven carefully here. Heaven knows. They analyzed it as a loss of morality, as a failure to value the family. You know, family values, all of that. But at least then and now, they speak to a real revolutionary crisis. The left does not know how to do that, even though it has a class analysis that would give it a brilliant way to explain it and a whole different set of solutions. Did sending the women out, did sending the teenagers out, did sending the retired people out solve the problem? Did it allow families to keep on consuming even though their wages went up? Answer is basically no. And the reason is that quickly it was discovered that for the wife to go out and work, they had a whole new set of expenses. It was very, very disappointing. She had to have another set of clothes because what you wear at home and what you wear in the job are not the same. Because we have no public transportation, they had to get a second car. Because she could no longer do the physical work of cooking, she had to buy prepared food on the way home at the prepared food joint. You know the story. All of those things are expensive. They literally ate up the extra income her paid labor brought in. So it didn't solve the problem of allowing consumption to rise for everybody in the family because it didn't suffice. So the American working class, starting in the 70s, had to find another way to allow consumption to keep going up when the wages didn't do it. And they found it. It's called debt. The American working class went on a borrowing binge no working class had ever gone under, had underway before in the history of the world. By the way, since then, several countries around the world have copied the United States and gone into comparable debt. The British, the Irish, the South Koreans, interesting group that did it. Many didn't. Germany didn't, for example. In any case, Americans went. First, they used up all their savings. In the 1960s, we had a high savings rate. Americans saved a good portion of their income. Starting in the 70s, that went down. And for the 90s, we didn't save anything. We had a zero and indeed a negative saving rate. So first, we used up our savings as a working class, and then we borrowed. We borrowed and we borrowed. And you know, for 20 years, it allowed consumption to go up. Now, it was the consumption of people who realized they were living on borrowed time. So they wanted to consume more and more, but they knew they had to get cheaper stuff. And it created a whole new industry that didn't exist 30 years ago. The industry, which I will use a technical term for, that delivers shit to the American people, right? Specialized crap. And whole countries are devoted to producing crap cheap for the United States. The number one country that proves to be the brilliant one that seized the potential is the People's Republic of China, which goes to work to become the greatest factory producer in the world, which it now is. But of course, the Chinese have a basic problem. They can only produce the stuff. They can't get it into the homes of Americans. They have no distribution system here. If they set up little shops all over the United States in which Chinese people did the work, it would take them years to do it, and everybody would be nervous about buying there. So they needed a partner. And they found an obscure little department store born in Bentonville, Arkansas, by the name of Walmart. Walmart and China struck a deal. I am not making this up, so please. Struck a deal. Walmart wanted to become a major department store. It is today the number one retailer in the world. It is the largest private employer in the United States. It went from nothing to absolute dominance. And it did that only because, and in the forever in the debt of the People's Republic of China. Walmart is a communist plot. Okay? The Chinese found a distributor. The Walmart found the cheap stuff. And the American workers did the rest, unborrowed. So now we come to 2007, looking at the working class, and what do we got? A destroyed class structure of the home, with all the trauma, psychological, personal, physical even. We are an obese culture. We have a lot of problems that have a lot to do with the breakup of the class structure of the home. We also have a working class that is working way too hard. Little fact for you. The OECD, a very important agency that measures economic trends around the world, keeps a record, a number of average hours worked per year by workers in different countries. We are number one. Americans work more hours per year than the Japanese, the Canadians, the British, the French, the Italians, the Germans, you name it. And the difference between us and the Germans and the French and the Italians, for example, 20%. They work 20% fewer hours per year than we do. We are exhausted as a people, physically exhausted. Because of the breakdown of the class structure of our households, we are emotionally stressed. And by 2007, we were carrying a level of debt that is unsupportable. You can't keep borrowing while your wages don't go anywhere because you have to pay it back. And the more you borrow, the bigger the cost of paying it back with interest. So you're building up a debt and not building up the basis to pay the debt. Hello? You got a problem here. And it's only a matter of time. In 2007, we got to the end of this game, as millions of working people couldn't pay their debts. They couldn't. They couldn't pay the house mortgage. They couldn't pay the credit card debt. They couldn't pay their student loan. They couldn't keep up their car payments. They couldn't. Not because they were not frugal, not because they were unwise in their purchases. Stop. I just gave you a 150-year history that brings us to that point. Blaming somebody in the light of that history is childish. To complete the story, let's look at the other side. I've been telling you about the workers. What about the capitalists? Well, starting in the 1970s, because they no longer had to raise wages, they made a fortune as workers produced more and more for the boss, but he didn't have to pay them anymore. What did the capitalists do? This is just as important in shaping the crisis as what the workers did that I've just gone through with you. But it is, of course, a Marxist analysis to tell the story around the relationship between the worker who produces the surplus and the capitalist who gets and distributes it. The surplus of capitalists went crazy, starting in the 70s. The first thing that the capitalists did, and for those of you that follow the financial press, you may enjoy this. The first thing that the capitalists did was to take a huge portion of the surplus enabled by no longer having to pay rising wages and pay it to themselves as huge salaries, bonuses, and commissions. Way more than they had paid themselves in the previous 150 years. But the genius of these folks was to say, and to justify taking this money and paying it to themselves in spectacular wages, spectacular bonuses. You know, you now read about them. By the way, you read about them now, 30 years late. This has been going on for 30 years in American corporate leadership. Americans are angry now, but it really is kind of late. How did the corporations justify this to themselves? As follows. We are making stunning profits because of our genius entrepreneurial skill. What? Yeah. We ought to be paid because it's our understanding of capitalism. It's our freedom here in America where we don't have a socialist government, we don't have high taxes. See, we have low taxes, and they told a wonderful story that made them the heroes of the piece. That's one of the reasons you couldn't be told that this wage story is all you need to understand it. They weren't geniuses. They were just cashing in on the good fortune of the end of a labor shortage in this country. But of course, they had to tell the story about how it was their genius, because how else could you justify the sudden spectacular increase in their salaries, stock options, bonuses, and everything else? So that's the first thing. Second thing, with this much money, corporations could undertake a very expensive act. You know, we talk glibly about moving production out of Toledo, Ohio, and into Taiwan, or out of Scarsdale, well, wrong choice, out of Mount Vernon and over to Southern Europe. But to move production is very expensive. Very, very expensive. And companies often don't do it because you'd have to make a lot more profit for a long time in the other place to win back the cost of the move itself. Well, if you're suddenly flush with cash, you have the money. The movement out became very spectacular, and we all began to discuss outsourcing, the massive movement of jobs out of the United States, which this profit. Third, this amount of money floating in the coffers of corporations, this amount of money now accumulating in the bank accounts of CEOs and shareholders and all the people cashing in on this bonanza, created a desire of the new rich. And you really have to understand the last 30 years as having produced a new kind of gilded age. It's what it was called in the United States at the end of the 19th century. At the end of the 19th century, we also had an explosion of capitalists with names you all learned, Rockefeller, Carnegie, Mellon, those kinds of names. We have a whole new set of names now of a whole new generation of them. Bill Gates, you know the names. So they have tons of money, and they need that money managed for them. And it becomes incredibly lucrative because they have wild amounts. So there begins to be an explosion of an industry catering to this explosion of wealthy people. And why? Because catering to anyone else in the United States is a no-win proposition. The American working people have no money. And what they have, they're spending in Walmart. So the profits to be made are to be pandering to these people. So a whole industry pandering to, what is it they want? They already have all the cars they can use. What they want, what they need, is people to profitably manage and invest their money. And so we have something called financialization. The explosion of the finance industry. Thousands of corporations with funny names, but they're all about the same thing, investing money for rich people. The most famous name, hedge fund. That's what it does. It invests the money of rich people. If you've never dealt with a hedge fund, it means you're not one of those people. A reality that may already have dawned on you. Okay? Now, hedge funds, who explode in number, there are whole blocks in New York City that's what it is. Hundreds, thousands of hedge funds in various parts of New York. Okay. The way hedge funds work is they compete for the money of rich people. You're a hedge fund, you want the rich person to give you 10, 20, 50 million that you can then invest because you get a big cut of whatever you do for him. All right? So the financial industry goes crazy. Millions of these funds are set up. Banks set them up because rich people don't want to put their money in the bank. That's what everybody does. They want to specialize. hedge fund, a specialized investment counselor, a specialized, all that. So an industry develops and an industry competes for rich people's money. And this industry does two things of importance in the last 30 years. Number one, it invents all new kinds of instruments that people can invest in. New gimmicks, new ideas. Credit default swaps, asset-backed securities. I'll mention a few of them. We don't have the time to go into them, but if you look at some of the literature I told you about, you will find it all described there. Not only does it invent new ones, but it comes up with the best one. And I always like to explain this one because it summarizes the whole story. These investment management companies came up with a brilliant idea. They said to the rich people, you know what? Here's a thing we can do with the money that you've gotten, because wages don't have to be paid higher anymore and productivity is rising. Here's something. The working class is desperate to continue consumption, but they haven't the wage increases to do it. They need loans. They need to borrow, and you've got a lot of money. So here's what we'll do. The rich will lend it to the workers, which is what they did. When I told you that the American working class went on a borrowing binge, it should have occurred to you, but who lent it to them? And the answer is, the capitalists lent it to them. They lent them all the money. Because it meant that the working class now was funding the capitalists two ways. First, by working and producing without having more wages. And secondly, by paying interest to the same people for the loans that substituted for the rising wages you used to get. At this point, I'd play the national anthem again. Because this is a genius way of organizing capitalism. This is genius. For a while. But it's only genius so long as you can keep it going. It's like something called a Ponzi scheme. You can keep it going until you can't anymore. And then, welcome Mr. Madoff. We don't have a Mr. Madoff, we have something much worse. We have the end of this. They took unbelievable chances, each hedge fund, to get money promised a higher and higher rate of return. So they had to find more Americans to lend to. So they lent to people who couldn't possibly pay it back. But for a while, it worked. So the capitalists, in the wild euphoria of this money, thinking themselves geniuses to have figured out a new way to have capitalism that is so profitable that will last forever, they bid the stock market up, 1980 to 2000, fastest run-up in stocks in the history of the stock market. Okay, so the stock market, they believed their own story. They had discovered, in the words of Alan Greenspan, then the head of the Federal Reserve, we living in a new economy. What he meant was not one that goes down and up, just up. Beware of anybody who tells you life always goes up. This is a person to turn around and leave quickly. Bad advice. By the way, Mr. Greenspan, to his credit, now admits he made basic mistakes. A little late, but look, most of the rest of them don't even admit that. So by 2007, these people had invested their money in much too risky a way, in a helter-skelter euphoria of it can't go wrong, producing all kinds of new instruments that nobody could even track. The government couldn't supervise. It was kind of out of control. And the whole house of cards, which was in the end dependent on the borrowing of the mass of the working class, collapsed. Marx, if he were standing here, would really enjoy the irony. The system is set off by the endless struggle of capitalists and workers. The capitalists had a chance to stop paying rising wages. They jumped, and in the process, they killed the goose that lays the egg. A famous radical once said, capitalists are so blind that they will sell to the hangman the noose that will eventually be placed around their necks. Here you have a system that is so built on the tension between workers and capitalists, on the need to get as much surplus and to have it, and is driven in its own competitive neurosis, that it will produce a situation, and now there is no escape. All that you have been seeing during the last three quarters of the year 2009, the so-called recovery of the newspapers, has been the government stepping in to try to bail out this disaster. The second major collapse of capitalism since the 1930s. I mean, the last one was the Great Depression. In 75 years, this system has collapsed two times, basically. And between the 1930s depression and the current one, we had 12 business cycle downturns. This is a level of instability where the only reasonable question is to ask of the people, why do you accept to live like this? In worry about what it'll do to your job, your family, your future, your chances. If you lived with a roommate who was as unstable as capitalism, you'd find a new roommate or demand that that roommate get professional help. But the mass of people who live in capitalism stay there and think there's nothing wrong with the system. Now that's an achievement, that level of ideological befuddlement. So, the recovery did what? The government came in, didn't waste any time on its own ideology. Remember the ideology of the 30 years, 1970 to 2000, and 40 years to 2010? Basic ideology was, private sector is dynamic and good, government is a drag. Hello, in 2007, the private sector collapses, and who does it call in to save it? The government. The big bad government is the only thing that can save us, and the bankers bring them in. And the government dutifully, having been called by the bankers, gives it to the bankers. Bails them out of their, and the hedge funds, all of them, bailed out. Huge amounts of money given to banks. Huge amounts of money pushed into the stock market. And the banks come back. And the stock market has risen 45 or 50% from March, its low in 2009, to today. Dramatic recovery. But only a dramatic recovery of the banks. What about the underlying problem? Are wages going up again? No. Are workers able to consume more? No. Are more members of the family going out to work? No, less are. Has anything been done about the basis out of which this story came? No. Over the 9 months in which the stock market went up and banks came back, the level of unemployment in the United States grew without interruption. Unemployment in the United States was in 2007, in December, was 7 million people. Today it's 16 million people. 300,000 people are facing foreclosure actions in court every month, new ones starting. Americans are losing their homes and their jobs at a record number. You should none of you be surprised that the mass of people feel completely alienated from the political establishment and everything else. Of course they go to tea parties. Anybody who's willing to throw a dart at the government and at business is listened to. So much so that I, a person like me, has done more public speaking and work on radio and television in the last 12 months than in my entire previous life here in the United States. Because even someone like me explaining it in this way is now listened to, has an audience. So I don't see any exit here. I don't think there is a recovery. I think there is a great deal of things going on, bailouts of banks, bailouts of big insurance companies like AIG, bailouts of companies that are defunct like General Motors, and so on. But mostly what the government is doing is a major theater of action. What's actually happening is that capitalism is going through a major crisis. And there will be unemployment, for a long time, until wages get driven down enough that employers will begin to hire us again because we're cheaper. And they'll hire us again because with so many companies going out of business, getting office space will be cheaper. Getting secondhand office equipment will be cheaper. Everything is becoming cheaper. And that's how capitalism works. Its crises wipe out businesses, unemployed people, driving down the cost of business until once again it's profitable for business to and the problem is only that while we wait, 1 year, 2 years, 4 years, 6 years, there may be political change in the population. That's dangerous. And how that will be dealt with as it begins to show itself now, and that's what the Tea Parties are. Unfortunately, only from the right, because the left hasn't figured out, even though this story is made for us, how to make an argument that takes this all in a different direction. So I don't expect solution. And it's my Marxian class analysis that made it possible for me to tell you this story. It's that framework that told me where to look for the statistics, that told me what factors to focus on, that helped me put them together. If you found this story interesting, if it made sense, if it gave you a picture, a feeling about this crisis, its roots in our economy, its trajectory, that isn't me. It's the Marxian class analytic that makes this story possible. And it also explains why this story hasn't been produced by people working with other frameworks, those you see on CNN or CBS or any place else, or in the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal. Or, unfortunately, in the Nation, I can continue. The problem is we need to revive and reapply Marxian class analysis because of what it did in the past and what it can do now, which is why we have this course at the Bryce Forum now. In the remaining weeks, three more, we will be analyzing, as you know from the syllabus, other phenomena using this class analysis. And I think you will see when we analyze the rise and fall of the Soviet Union, when we analyze households, when we analyze the history of the working class and of labor unions and radical organizations, we're going to use this class analysis. You're going to see very interesting. You may not be persuaded by all of them. That's not really my goal. My goal is to illustrate, to exemplify, to prove to you that not having been taught a Marxian class analysis, not having learned how to use it, how to apply it, has simply deprived you and all the people you interact with from ways of understanding their own situations. That's a tragedy in terms of the lost political opportunities that might have been realized had that been done. Even now, with a crisis as terrible as this one is, we see a specter in which the left wing of the United States, of which I'm a part, cannot come up with anything like a serious intellectual argument about what caused this problem and about what has to be done about it. So we're left making vague gestures like, let me quote you, there ought to be a bigger stimulus program, or stop. Who is this government? An independent agency that we appeal to? You got to be kidding. Over the last 30 years, as workers had no wage increases and capitalists got a lot of money, guess what happened? Workers with no wages to go up, with their families falling apart for the reasons I went through with you, with women going out to work, with everybody exhausted, here's one of the things they did. They stopped participating in American politics. They withdrew. There's a wonderful book I've mentioned many times, I want to mention to you before, written by a Harvard professor named Robert Putnam. The book is called Bowling Alone. It was a bestseller. He's not a Marxist or anything like that. He's a sociologist who documents how, over the last 30 years, Americans stopped doing things with other people. They turned inward. They didn't go bowling in leagues, which was once a big activity. Now, they bowl alone. That's the idea of the title. They withdrew from church. They withdrew from civic associations. They withdrew from politics. At the same time that the working class withdrew, the capitalists were floating in money. So they used their money to buy the politicians. So ask yourself, if you were a state senator, in Boise, Idaho, or wherever. You had a working class that wasn't coming to your meetings anymore, that didn't care, didn't pay attention, didn't know what you were doing. But an army of well-paid lobbyists sent by business who followed your every move, who knew whose bed you were in and shouldn't have been, when, who knew how to give you support at the time of your election, who could help you in every... Did American politics turn to the right? No. The mass of Americans withdrew from political involvement. They don't care anymore. They haven't got the space and the time. At the same time that the other half of this equation moved in to make politics serve them. And that's why it works that way. In other words, here is a class analysis of the change in politics. Instead of asking yourself, what happened? Why did American working people become right-wing? They didn't. They withdrew. They withdrew. They don't care. They either don't bother to vote, which we see, or they wait until the night before, look at TV, and vote for one or the other. But what the hell difference does it make? Which is not an argument that there aren't differences between Republicans and Democrats. It may be an argument that I haven't paid enough attention. I don't notice any difference, which is true enough. If you don't pay a lot of attention, you won't notice much difference. So a class analysis could be the vehicle, a Marxian class analysis, that would allow us to begin to understand what happened and to frame an argument. When we turn later in this course to looking at the household again in great detail, as we're going to do, I'm going to be able to present you, hopefully you will be persuaded by it, but in any case, persuade you with a whole program for the collapsed American family and household that comes out of a class analysis, and that is radically different from a right-wing celebration of some ancient family values or cutting off abortion or all the other things that they create as their solution that will make us all go back to the happy family we once had. And you'll see the radically different way that a class analytic comes up with it. We don't know whether the American people would respond enormously, a little, or in between to a leftist analysis. And the reason we don't know is no one is putting it out there. So we have to make a change. Okay, we've taken our class analysis. We've done an analysis of the crisis, its explosion, its origins, and its very deep roots. The whole idea is to become more comfortable and familiar with using this kind of class analysis. I will see you again a week from tonight. We will take it to a whole new area, and I promise you as interesting an explanation there as this was this evening. Thank you very much. And if any of you are interested in either the book or the DVD that goes through this, the cards for those things are available here. Please take one. And ditto about the Left Forum that's happening next month here in New York. If any of you are interested, this has information about that as well. The Left Forum this year, one last thing about the Left Forum this year, March 19th to 21st at Pace University down at City Hall. It will be the largest Left Forum ever in history. We will have 7 time slots of panels, and there will be at least 30 panels each of the sessions. So you do the math, it's over 220 panels that we will have. The opening plenary will feature Jesse Jackson, who wanted to come and give a talk, and the closing plenary will feature Noam Chomsky. So it'll be an unusual and I think an interesting time. Many, many publishers and organizations will have their tables and displays. It's a really elaborate process, and I hope you will take advantage of all the people coming here to present their work and to debate the future of the left. Thank you, thank you.